and welcome to the Skeptical Experience, a weekly radio show discussing, debating, conjugating, disseminating, and maybe even full-blown arguing about anomalous beliefs and skepticism, from gods to ghosts, haunting to homeopathy, witches to general woo-woo. This week's guest is Professor Chris French, creator of Goldsmith's own Anomalistic Psychology Research Unit. Regular on TV and radio, he's a writer, editor of The Skeptic magazine, occasional columnist for The Guardian, and most known to most of us as the guy at the end of Most Haunted Who Made Sense. Hello, Chris.
Hello.
Hello. Okay.
Just have to do a quick correction there, Richard. I never actually appeared on Most Haunted.
Oh, haven't you? Which one was it?
Ours was called Haunted Homes.
Oh, yes.
And
I get them mixed
basically
up.
We never actually faked anything, so nothing ever happened, so we didn't get a third series.
Oh, well, yes. I can't think why that would be. You're suggesting they fake things on Most Haunted?
Oh, certainly not on Haunted Homes, I hasten to add. I couldn't possibly comment on Most Haunted.
No, of course not. Oh, dear. Right, you are expecting a grandchild.
Yes, today is the due date. I've checked the statistics, and according to one website, I believe that less than 5% of women actually deliver on their due date. So I'm hoping we don't get interrupted and I don't have to whip my daughter off to the maternity ward halfway through.
How rational a world do you think your grandchild will be born into?
I think the basic kind of level of rationality probably hasn't changed enormously over the last few hundred years. I think there's a kind of general assumption that, particularly among sceptics maybe, that we are looking at kind of paranormal beliefs and other kind of associated weird beliefs, and that these are some kind of deviation from a rational norm. Now, in fact, I don't think the norm is that rational. I think these cognitive biases that we have that make us all intuitively quite irrational, I think they're there throughout. And basically I think it's as interesting to talk about the psychology of scepticism as it is to talk about the psychology of belief.
Right. So what is the focus then, leading from the psychology of scepticism, of your anomalistic psychology research unit?
Anomalistic psychology is mainly focused on trying to come up with and test non-paranormal explanations for ostensibly paranormal experiences. So the working hypothesis is that paranormal forces don't exist. So can we explain all these weird things that people report, whether we're talking about UFOs or ghosts or telepathy or all those other kind of things that people are so interested in, can we explain them without having to invoke paranormal forces? And the kinds of things that we look at are cognitive biases that might lead people to draw the wrong conclusion, to interpret an experience or a situation in a way where they are convinced that something paranormal's happened, but maybe we could show that in fact it didn't. And things like memory biases and false memories and hallucinations and all these other, a whole very wide range of different factors, but to try and look at those systematically as they apply to attempting to explain these experiences. And I also think it's very important that we have to produce evidence. It's not just the people who believe in the paranormal who have the burden of proof. If we're saying, no, we don't think that these experiences are anything to do with visitation by spirit, we think it's sleep paralysis, we have to produce evidence that supports our account of things as well.
Okay. You're very interested in this whole area of scepticism. What do you say, from what you just said, what do you say to people who say sceptics are closed-minded? That's a closed-minded philosophy.
That's one of the kind of statements that really annoys me, because the one thing about true scepticism, and I think we do need to be careful here that there are lots of people who might label themselves as sceptics who have got a basic attitude that, well, basically it's all rubbish, isn't it? And that's as far as it goes, and they don't think you need to look at the evidence or think about it any further. I don't think of that as being my version of scepticism. Scepticism is about saying, show me the evidence, convince me. And being open to a very wide range of possibilities, but always, before you accept any particular claim, being keen, and particularly a controversial claim, being keen to see how good evidence is, and to critically assess that evidence. Now, part of that, one of the major criticisms that skeptics make of pseudoscientists is that very often the claims that are being put forward are non-falsifiable. So in which case, I think it's very important that skeptics live by that rule as well. We have to be able to say what would convince us that telepathy really did exist, what would convince us that psychokinesis really did exist, that UFOs really did exist. Now, typically, you'll find that people who follow this kind of version of skepticism that I would advocate, they will be able to tell you that. It won't be a situation where they say, I just know I'm right. Now, interestingly, the people who often accuse skeptics of being closed-minded are precisely people who could never be convinced they're wrong. The obvious example here would be any kind of religious fundamentalist. If you were to say to any kind of religious fundamentalist, is there anything that could happen that would persuade you that your faith is misguided, that what you believe isn't true? They'll usually say, often with great satisfaction, no. They know in their hearts it's true. Now, again, that's just completely the antithesis of a sceptical approach, and I'd say even of a scientific approach. What we're about is, well, show us the evidence, convince us that it's true. If the evidence is in favour of the hypothesis, then for the time being, we'll accept it. And that's the other thing about science, that it's never about absolute truth. It's about trying to move towards truth, but always accepting that any answers that we've got are just the best answers we have on the basis of the currently available evidence, and that that may change as new evidence comes in.
So it's burden of proof.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And meeting that burden of proof.
Yeah.
What is the line of burden of proof to you? When in the process would you say, actually, there's really something in this?
Well, again, as I say, I'd never have a position where I said that I knew with absolute certainty that hypothesis X was either definitely right or definitely wrong. I think that the weight of evidence can sometimes be overwhelmingly in favour of one hypothesis or another. Sometimes you'll hear sceptics saying, and I say these are the kind of fairly ignorant, uninformed sceptics, there's no evidence at all in favour of ESP to support the existence of ESP. Well, that's just wrong. There is lots of evidence. The question is about the quality of the evidence and whether or not we should find it convincing, and what are the problems with the evidence, what are the strengths of it. But to just say there's none is rubbish. Now, when it comes to what would actually convince me that I was wrong, again, it's the same thing. I'd never get to a point where I said, I now definitely know that ESP really does exist. But if I could find a replicable phenomenon which, under well-controlled conditions, again, we're not talking about 100% replicability. Science doesn't work like that, particularly social sciences. But if we could find some kind of reasonably replicable phenomenon that independent scientists could produce in their own laboratories, and that would go a long way to convincing me that, hey, maybe telepathy really does exist. Sometimes these claims are made, and over the years we have put a lot of time into actually testing these claims directly, and to date I've never produced any evidence that I found compelling that paranormal forces really do exist. And I have tried. I have put a lot of time into this.
What do you, on that, say to these people who either will not or go on the James Randi million dollar
yeah.
test, or have been on it and say that in some way it was wrong, or the energies were wrong in the room, or any other excuse?
Well, again, I think most listeners will know about James Randi's Million Dollar Challenge, but just in case there's anybody out there that doesn't, James Randi has on offer $1 million for anyone who can prove, under well-controlled conditions, that they have psychic abilities. I think I'm right in saying that relatively recently, the challenge was changed so it now can't be anyone. It has to be someone who already has an established media profile.
Right.
But you'd have still thought, there are lots and lots of psychics out there who claim they can work these miracles. Why aren't they queuing up to demonstrate this to Randi and get the $1 million? A lot of them come up with reasons like, you can't use this gift for profit, for personal profit. Well, don't. Give it to charity. A lot of really worthy causes out there, But another objection that you hear is that people say, well, the whole thing's a fix. Randi would never actually part with the money, or the money's not there. The money is there, it's not a fix. But for anybody who genuinely believes that it is, my advice would be, go for the challenge anyway. And then there's only two possibilities. If you genuinely got these amazing powers and you can demonstrate them under controlled conditions, either you will pass the test and you will get the money, or you can reveal to the world that the whole thing was a setup and it was fixed, and that Randy had actually set the whole thing up so that you couldn't possibly win, and his reputation will be in tatters. Now, I know from working with James Randi and in actually carrying out the preliminary tests, because Randi insists, I think not unreasonably, that before you can go for the formal $1 million challenge, you first have to pass a preliminary test carried out by someone that he knows and trusts. And we have actually carried out various tests in terms of that preliminary challenge. Nobody ever gets past the preliminary challenge stage, because if the test is properly carried out, it's highly unlikely that they will. Right. But I can guarantee that the amount of effort and time that goes into setting up those tests to ensure two things: one, that they are properly controlled, and two, that the person being tested believes and, well, knows that the test is a fair test. There is absolutely no point at all in testing a psychic claimant who says from the outset, well, I just can't do this task, or I can't do it under these conditions. So what you have to do is work very hard to come up with a protocol that the claimant is happy with. They have to sign a statement before the test begins saying that the test is fair, that they think they'll pass the test, and so on. And we really do bend over backwards. And by we there, I mean not just me and my colleagues at the APRU, but James Randi and his colleagues work very, very hard to ensure that that is the case. And then what typically happens is that the claimant will fail the test, and then retrospectively they'll decide that actually the test wasn't fair at all for reasons X, Y, and Z. And clearly it's then just a matter of kind of rationalising it away. Typically it doesn't dent their own faith and their own abilities, because typically most of the people who would put themselves forward for this kind of test, they genuinely believe they have a gift. There are con artists out there, but those con artists wouldn't put themselves forward for a test like this, because they know that, particularly somebody like James Randi, they're not going to fool him. He knows all the tricks of the trade.
Yes, I'm just going to say to the other room, since no one can hear us, that everyone's getting a error, page not working, or page down for maintenance on the Wired Radio. So you're probably going to be listening to this on the podcast later. If it comes up, then great. Okay, we'll carry on.
Even if we're not live.
Okay, was there a moment, a process that made you into a sceptic, or is it just something you've always been?
No, I've not actually. I used to be a believer. I think that's a fairly open secret. I'm not coming out of the closet there. Just a small indication of the fact that I've got some hard evidence to support the fact I was a believer. I remember as a sixth former at school, New Scientist ran a survey about their readers' attitudes towards parapsychology and the paranormal. And I was kind of into it enough to actually bother to fill it in and post it off, basically saying that, I thought this was a really important area and that we should do research, and basically very much from a kind of believer's perspective. Because I had a kind of general interest, I'd read various books. I remember thinking that Eric von Daniken's stuff was really brilliant. I mean, it was written in a book, so it must be true, mustn't it? I look back now and, oh my God, it's very embarrassing. But there you go. At the time, as a teenager, that's what I felt. And it wasn't really until I was doing my PhD at Leicester on a completely different topic, nothing to do with the paranormal. A friend of mine recommended a particular book by a Canadian psychologist called James Alcock. Right. And the book was called Parapsychology, Science or Magic. I think it was published in 1981. Very good book, still well worth reading. And I remember reading this and it was one of those kind of, well, you see, now one of those life-changing moments with the benefit of hindsight, because I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now if it wasn't for reading this book. And this is a social psychologist who basically showed that there was another side, there was another way to think about all these things, and that a lot of these psychological explanations were, in fact, I found, really, really interesting. And I think I went from being a believer to being a fairly extreme sceptic. It was at that point that I realised there was a magazine called The Sceptical Inquirer, and I started to subscribe to that, and I learned about James Randi, and I read Flim Flam, and I read The Truth About Uri Geller, and realised there was a sceptical literature out there, even if maybe there were not quite so many skeptical books on the shelves at W.H. Smith's as there were pro-paranormal books. And I must confess, at the time I had a kind of an attitude that all parapsychologists were completely incompetent and didn't know how to run an experiment and so on and so forth. I've now kind of modified that opinion because I've actually got to know a lot of parapsychologists, and a lot of them are highly intelligent people, and they do know about experimental design. There's a lot of good aspects to parapsychology. Having said that, I'm still not convinced that paranormal forces really do exist, but I think there's an interesting topic there for a kind of genuine, respectful debate between the kind of moderates on each side. And so, as I say, I've kind of gone from being a believer to being an extreme skeptic to coming back towards the middle ground. But, you know, I still edit the Skeptic magazine, and I've not seen anything yet that would convince me that paranormal forces really do exist. Having said that, one thing that's undeniable is that most of the population of Britain, of the Western world generally, and indeed most other cultures that we've ever looked at, either geographically or historically, a substantial proportion, typically a majority, do believe in what we would label as the paranormal, and a substantial minority claim to have had direct personal experience of it. And so as a psychologist, this is absolutely fascinating. What is going on here? If we up until fairly recently, I'd say, with one or two notable exceptions, psychology hasn't had anything to say about those kinds of experiences, and certainly hasn't really taken any position with respect to paranormal claims other than a kind of knee-jerk, you know, rejection of them. I think they deserve more serious attention than that, and the point is that if paranormal forces don't exist, then we can learn a hell of a lot about human psychology by studying these experiences and trying to understand them and get to grips with them.
Okay. Ever been impressed by a psychic?
I have been impressed by one or two. The vast majority, no, I have to say. They're just really, really, really unimpressive. I've said before that occasionally I've seen Gordon Smith, the psychic barber, as he used to be known, perform. And he sometimes, when he's doing his readings, comes up with information that seems to me to be a bit too specific to be just good old cold reading.
Right.
Now, that either means, in my book, that he's a very good con artist, which is a possibility that I can't rule out, or that just maybe he's the real thing. Now, he's somebody I really would like to kind of get to cooperate in a proper test. He's very busy, I'm very busy. You know, if we could get maybe some nice TV program, some TV company, I should say, to actually fund research to make it worth Gordon giving up his valuable time to take part in a proper test, I'd be more than happy to be involved in doing that. Say the vast majority of the of self-proclaimed psychics that we've tested, are just unimpressive. They can't deliver the goods, no matter how big the claims and how confidently they're made. And we've tested quite a number over the years. Again, typically for TV programmes, because that's a situation where it actually costs quite a lot, both in terms of time and effort, but also in terms of just money and resources, to set up one of these tests properly. So, of course, if a TV company are making a documentary about a particular psychic, they will be footing the bill for all that stuff, and so it makes it much more likely that you can do it and you do it properly. So we've tested the baby psychic, Derek Ogilvie. Yeah. He's a guy who claimed that he could read babies' minds even before they had learned to talk. I won't go into the details of the test. Suffice it to say that he just kind of performed totally at chance level and was very upset. He was in tears afterwards. I remember being there in this very building where we did the test, comforting him afterwards, saying kind of, "Don't worry, Derek, you know, none of your fans will take any notice of the test results at all. They'll still believe you've still got psychic powers," which turned out to be true. I tested Chris Robinson, who claims that he could dream the future. He calls himself the dream detective. Again, he failed the test. We've tested dowsers, we've tested all kinds of people, and so far, zilch, nothing.
Okay. Just to say hello to people now that we're on air, apparently.
Fantastic. Hooray!
I'm here, I'm Richard Godfrey here. This is the Skeptical Experience. I'm here with Chris French, Professor Chris French, talking about scepticism in general and his unit, the Anomalistic Psychology Research Unit. So, what you got going on at the APRU right now?
Well, basically, our research is kind of, there's two strands to it, really. One strand is that which I consider to be kind of really the more kind of mainstream anomalistic psychology, if that's not a contradiction in terms. And that's really focused on trying to understand ostensibly paranormal experiences and paranormal beliefs, but in terms of conventional psychological factors. And we've always got kind of undergraduate projects and postgraduate projects and other ongoing work in those kinds of areas. Some of the other strand, which, as I say, is a minor strand, but still an important one, and one that we do put a lot of effort into, is actually directly testing psychic claims. Now, a couple of things in particular on that front at the moment. We are engaged in an ongoing test of telephone telepathy. And we're really, really interested in getting participants for this. So if we just describe what's involved. This is some work we're doing in collaboration with Rupert Sheldrake, who is a very controversial scientist who apparently has the golden touch and seems to get lots of positive results when he actually tests various claims relating to telepathy and other phenomena. The telephone telepathy thing, as you probably guess, refers to the not uncommon phenomenon where people sometimes before they answer the phone are convinced that they know who's calling even before they pick it up, even though there wasn't a call expected at that particular time. Now, the skeptics, including myself, would say, well, a lot of those experiences can be explained just in terms of it was a coincidence. The number of people you think about in a day and the phone doesn't go at all, or the phone does go and it's not that person, you forget all of those because they're non-events. When the phone goes and it is the person you were just thinking of, and particularly if it was somebody maybe that you'd not heard from for a while, then, you know, you do kind of wonder, wow, that was pretty amazing. Yeah, maybe it was a psychic link. Well, maybe. And, of course, the selective remembering and forgetting, all of those factors come into it. I mean, Sheldrake is fully aware of all those kind of factors, but still asks the question, well, might there be something in it anyway? And so he's collected data which he says shows that there really is something in it. And the basic design is very simple. The original studies that he did involved having one receiver and four potential callers, and at various pre-specified times one of the four callers would be randomly selected, and they would make the call, and before the receiver picked the phone up they'd have to say it's either Bob or Ted or Carol or Alice or whoever it is. And you'd expect a hit rate of 25%, one in four, just by chance. And in some of the studies that Sheldrake reports, he says he gets hit rates way above that, up into 40-odd%.
Wow.
Now, the version we're doing at the moment, we have already done some previous work with Rupert, and we didn't get any positive results. But we're doing a mobile telephone version of it, which ought, in principle, to be easier. If any of your listeners wanted to take part, I'm afraid we don't want sceptics. We only want believers. The reason being that if there really was something in this claim, sceptics could deliberately screw up the results. Now, I know that sceptics wouldn't do that because they're all really nice people. But we have to have people who genuinely believe in this phenomenon, genuinely believe they've experienced it themselves, and would be willing to take part. They would have to nominate three people with whom they feel they have this special link. So it's not four as in the original studies, it's just three. The receiver would be filmed during the test just to rule out any possibility of any cheating. And the senders could all be going about their daily business, provided that they were ready to respond should the call come, that they had to make a call. The whole system's automated, and it's run by some software that's on Rupert Sheldrake's website. We're very keen to get people to take part and see whether there just might be anything in this.
Okay, sounds very interesting. Who is your favourite, I suppose is the best word, sceptical thinker? Is there anyone in particular who has, other than Alcock?
I think Jim Alcock would have to have a special place there,
yes.
And to be fair, I actually still feel very, I'm very chuffed that I actually is now a personal friend. I kind of to know somebody, you know, who's but you read ages ago, who you now think of as a personal friend. I often blame him for, you know, my life as it now is. But there are lots, actually. I think probably if I had to single out one person, it may well be Carl Sagan, I think. Right. Because, I'm a huge fan of James Randi. I'm a huge fan of Richard Wiseman and Susan Blackmore and all these other people. Ray Hyman is a fantastic guy, really, really nice. And again, really very influenced by their writings and by their thinking and their whole approach. One of the things about Carl Sagan was his willingness to accept that he may be wrong. Mm. And I'm not saying that all these other people don't. I'm just saying that that was a very upfront part of Sagan's scepticism, and I always liked that. But all of those other people are also kind of huge influences and big heroes of mine as well. And I'm sure the list would go on. So anybody I've left out, I hope not offended you. But there are some elements to Sagan's approach in particular that really kind of chime with my own feeling on these issues.
Okay, I'm going to do my weekly spot, which is going to be basically Internet Character of the Week. The internet, as you may know, has allowed certain characters who might not be in the mainstream to air their views. And so each week I'm going to play a little montage made by somebody I know, because frankly I haven't got time, I'm a student. And then we'll discuss what we think about this person afterwards. So have a listen to this guy. This gentleman calls himself Nephilim Free, and this was done by the YouTube giant Thunderfoot.
The subject of this video is controversial. There will be people who say I'm deluded, I'm an idiot, whatnot, for saying the things I'm going to say in this video. I really don't care. God has revealed the truth to me, and I've had experiences that prove to me what I'm about to say is the truth. I'm not here for me. I'm here because God has told me to do this. Until about 10 or 15 years ago, anyone who believed in aliens was considered a conspiracy theorist or a Christian. All I can tell you is that I'm a perfectly sane, highly intelligent person who has a firm grasp on reality. Of the many, 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 many testimonies of people who have been visited by aliens, you will find that they commonly describe three, often sometimes four or five, but the most common are three kinds of alien. There's the alien gray, there is a black dwarf, and there is a reptilian. I'm here because God has told me to do this. All I can tell you is that I'm a perfectly sane alien gray. God told me he wanted me to do what I'm doing. The alien gray is a genetic mixture between human and insect. Probably praying mantis kind. I'm a perfectly sane. This visitation that I had by this angel, highly intelligent person who has a firm grasp on a perfectly sane. God has revealed the truth to me. Millions of people in this world have experienced visitation by what we call aliens. They are not aliens. They are the offspring of the angels which cast from heaven, which scripture tells us bred themselves with humans and created a race of giants. And so I'm mulled over this visitation that I had by this angel of angels which cast from heaven, bred themselves with humans, and I felt someone tap me with their knuckles sticking out like this in the middle of my back. Tap, tap. And I turned my head over and I rolled, and it was a comely looking African woman, about 22 years old, with long black hair. And she said to me, a smaller aperture causes an increase in songs are about sex. A smaller aperture, because sex is Satan's greatest tool for defining me. And so I mulled over this visitation that I had by this angel. This tells us clearly and unarguably that angels reproduced with humankind and produced an offspring, the alien gray. The black dwarf is a mixture between ape and man, probably chimpanzee. I saw it as it happened, because sex is Satan's greatest tool. And so God is telling me, you know, son, I have a job for you. I want you to use YouTube to do it. Because sex is Satan's greatest tool. Highly intelligent, highly educated people are coming forward and stating that they believe aliens are real. Or they can gang up on me in a group, right? Well, until about 10 or 15 years ago, anyone who believed in aliens was considered a conspiracy theorist or a Christian. All I can tell you is that I'm a perfectly sane, highly intelligent person who has a firm grasp on reality.
Sorry about the blast there at the end. Right, that was Nephilim Free, interesting new internet person of the week. He is a geocentrist, a creationist, a fundamentalist literalist Christian, and believes aliens are descended from giants. He also has nearly 5,000 subscribers.
Yep.
Interesting. What do you think of his theory that aliens are the descendants of angels who bred with giants?
Where do we begin? That's the first time I've heard that. And, there is obviously so much in there that's all being kind of linked together. I mean, this is kind of not uncommon in the world of the paranormal that, you know, crop circles are linked with aliens, are linked with conspiracy theorists, are linked with this, are linked with that, and the whole thing seems one kind of giant network. I don't even know where you'd begin to... I can think of so many places to begin that I'm spoiled for choice. I mean, clearly, I think one of the kind of fundamental things there is that this guy is obviously accepting the Bible as literally true, and yes, that's a starting point. Nothing can be questioned if it contradicts the Bible. Therefore, you know, in sharp contrast to a kind of skeptical approach which says, well, we don't accept any authority, we don't accept any statements, no matter who made them, whether it be kind of a world famous scientist or whether it be Joe Bloggs or whoever. The question is, what does the empirical testing of that idea tell us? Now, clearly, this guy's not up for that, you know. Therefore, he can hold views that clearly are contradicted by the scientific evidence, and that's not going to move him one iota. He's going to stick to his beliefs. And he's got this very nice, it sounds like rather elaborate belief system, yes. And I'm sure that any bit of evidence you put in front of him, he could bat away. It's what Stephen Law calls a kind of, you know, the kind of idea of an intellectual black hole, where you've got a belief system that is impervious to any kind of outside influence. It's completely self-contained and self-supporting and reinforcing. No evidence is ever going to contradict that.
Well, just to let you know a bit more about him, he believes himself to be an expert geologist. And one of his theories is the reason there are craters on the moon is because of the waters of the deep when they broke for the flood, fired and scarred the moon.
Of course.
See?
What fools we've been.
You know?
Yeah. It's so obvious now you've said it. It just didn't occur to me at the time.
And also the reason why magnetism in rocks changes every now and again is because they were flipped over at this point.
Right.
Some of them.
Right.
So it's all so clear now.
Yeah. I think this guy ought to get a Nobel Prize.
Yes.
I mean, if there is any justice in the world.
Yes. Okay, let's move on. You can find Nephilim Free. It's Nephilim Free. It's just one word on YouTube, if you like. And also Thunderfoot. If you're on YouTube at all, you'll know him anyway. He's a giant. So I'd like to thank him for that. And I'll, of course, shout him out. So, right. Where shall we go from here? I'm kind of numbed by Nephilim Free. I have to become be honest.
One of the things I wanted to kind of mention, was a story that had been in the... Not so much the kind of... the mainstream newspapers, but certainly in a lot of the psychology magazines and New Scientist and so on, an interesting story that was reported in some research by a guy called Daryl Bem,
right,
who's a very, very well-respected social psychologist, been around for years, has a huge reputation. One of the things about him is a little bit of a maverick, and he's a well-known supporter and proponent of the paranormal, and he's recently... had a paper accepted for publication in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, which is a very well-respected journal published by the American Psychological Association, which is, you know, those are the journals we all want to publish in. That's the place to be. Now, the interesting thing is that this paper that he's had accepted is basically arguing that there is convincing evidence, and he reports 9 experiments in the paper, that... various kind of precognitive effects really do exist. Now, the particular approach that he takes, and there's lots of different experiments, and they're using different techniques, but the basic approach that he takes is to take various standard and accepted psychological paradigms, which involve a situation where event A, the presentation of some particular stimulus, for example, actually has an effect on the processing of event B. Again, maybe some stimulus being presented. And what he's claiming is that you can actually get these effects operating retroactively in time.
Right.
So let me give you a specific example. If you get people to perform what's called a lexical decision task, which is where on each trial you have to decide whether or not a letter string is a real word or not, and you measure the reaction time. It's well established that if you precede the target letter string with a word that is semantically related, so the actual letter string is the word doctor, for example, but you present the word nurse before that, then people respond more quickly to say doctor is a word. And
right.
You know, this makes sense in terms of all kinds of psychological theories about spreading semantic activation and so on. You even get these effects if the first word is presented subliminally. So you put it so briefly that you can't consciously see it. So it's really interesting. Now, one of the things that Behm is claiming is that you can actually get these effects when you actually present the what's called the prime word, the word that usually appears first, after you've presented the target string. So what you do in a study like this would be to have two sets of trials. You would present the letter string, the person makes the decision as to whether or not it's a word on each trial, and only after that does the computer make a decision as to whether or not this is going to be a primed word or not. And if it's a primed word, it then presents the prime after the target word has been presented. Now, in terms of, you know, physics as we understand it, this cannot have any effect on an event that's already taken place previously in time. Behm says he does get these effects. And one of the things about this is that he has made his software available to people who want to replicate.
Right.
So, and I think this is the important thing. I know these kinds of effects have been around in the parapsychology literature for a very long time. I say a very long time, at least a decade or more. And over that time, I have had postgraduate students who have tried to replicate these effects, and we just don't get them. They don't happen for us.
Right.
Now, yeah, why might that be? Some people would say, oh, it's because I'm a skeptic and therefore it's my bad vibes that are affecting the situation. Maybe, but the students who are collecting the data, they're not skeptics, and I think they'd really like to prove me wrong on this, you know, and it just doesn't happen. Anyway, we are doing the only thing that we think it is fair to do, and we are attempting to replicate some of Behm's effects, and we'll let you know how that goes. So we're currently setting up an experiment. We've looked at the experiments that Behm reports in this paper. We've taken the one with the largest effect size. That gives us the best chance of getting an effect if there's one there to be got. And we are currently in the process of setting that up, and we'll be collecting data. So if anybody's interested in taking part, I won't go into the details of the particular experiment that we're going to do, because it's best if people go through it. We will explain it to them after they've taken part in the trial. But if we get a paranormal effect, then we will tell the world that's what we've found. It would be absolutely amazing if we found it. It'd be slightly embarrassing for me, I have to confess. But I think I'd be big enough to get over that. And also, I mean, I don't have a problem in terms of if I come across the real thing, I'm quite happy to go for James Randi's $1 million challenge, you know. That would certainly...
Wrap me a check.
Exactly.
Yes, yeah. It would be interesting for a sceptic to get that prize.
It would indeed,
you know?
Yeah. There'd be a great irony in that, you know. somebody tells me it's not going to happen, but it's a nice idea. I mean, being serious, this is one of the reasons why I'm quite open for when we can fit it in. I mean, and I have to emphasise that, because we don't have the time to test everyone's psychic claims personally. But when we can actually fit it in, or again, if it's part of say a TV programme where it's going to become worth the effort, we are open to the idea of testing psychic claimants. And if we ever found one that was the real thing and could really do this stuff properly under controlled conditions, then great, we go for Randi's $1 million challenge. And I'm not a greedy man, I'll just take 10%. You know?
And the pints will be on you.
Hey.
Yes, I came up with my own little thing that has been floating around Twitter sphere and other areas. This is a book called Ruth Montgomery Writes Again. I'd like to know your opinion of it. Basically, I'll read out the blurb. The human race is at a critical juncture. Famed author and spiritualist Ruth Montgomery and her spirit guides are communicating from the other side with crucial information that can help humanity save itself from destruction. Since 2002, the members of the Makoba family have been involved in the most amazing experience of their lives, receiving communications via automatic writing transmissions from the spirit of the late award-winning journalist Ruth Montgomery. These transmissions occur when the energy of a departed spirit enters the body and moves the pen in the hand across the paper on its own. So basically what we've got here is dead people writing books via spirit writing.
There's a fine tradition in that line, young man.
Yes, is there really?
Ever since the very birth of spiritualism, which was kind of 1848 in Hydesville in New York State, where the Fox sisters reported, these two young girls reported that they could hear these strange rapping sounds, and they worked out that this was actually a spirit and they could communicate with the spirit, you know, not once but yes, not twice but no, that kind of thing. And this generated a huge amount of interest initially in the local neighbourhood. People would come round and see this. The girl's mother was scared out of her wits. Their elder sister realised this was actually quite a good way of making money, and she kind of took this as far as it would go. The whole thing then spread. Other people found that they could also produce these weird effects, and basically seances became more and more elaborate. One of the things that happened was that people realised that if you worked out a code, you could actually have whole books dictated from the other side. Now, this was a very laborious process, because this code would be, if you wanted the 22nd letter of the alphabet, this was 22 raps, and then you'd try to write down that one letter and then go on to the next letter. But people did it. They spent all this time producing these books. Spiritualism just took off like wildfire, you know, spread all around the world, certainly all across America and Europe. And it caused great excitement at the time. You know, people really, really took this seriously. There were always skeptics. There were always people who didn't believe the Fox sisters. But it wasn't actually until 40 years later, in 1888, this was just a few years after the Society for Psychical Research was founded, that these girls, they basically confessed that the whole thing had been just a schoolgirl prank. And the way they made their noises, they used various techniques, but one of them was that they had this strange ability to make loud cracking noises from their joints. Ooh. And and as I say, but this obviously taking this back, this spiritualist movement was up and running and so powerful by then that nothing was going to stop it. One of the interesting things, I mean, about automatic writing is, you know, okay, on the one hand, it might be discarnate spirits that are somehow possessing a person and causing them to write these messages, or it might be that the people are writing the messages themselves, even if they're not consciously aware of it. And there are a whole host of other phenomena that are similar. There's kind of the Ouija board, for example. There's dowsing. There are various other phenomena, I say, which I won't go into. But the obvious counter-explanation is that either these people are deliberately faking it, I suspect they're not, or that they are actually moving the pen or pencil, but without realising they're doing it. Now, the evidence that is probably the correct explanation is fairly strong, to say the least. One of the crazes that took off when spiritualism was in its heyday was something called table tilting, where typically people would stand around a small, round, fairly light table. They'd put their hands on the table and they'd address questions to the spirits. And if it was a good session, the table would kind of judder and then maybe really start to move. And on a really good session, they could end up kind of chasing around the room, trying to keep their hands in contact with this table that was apparently being pushed around by the spirits.
I kind of hope I've got better things to do if I become a spirit. But,
you know. Yeah, well, I mean, some of the messages they bring back are fairly profound as well. You know? We're all very happy. But one of the interesting things about this episode was that it was one of the first to attract the attention of any kind of serious scientist. It was Michael Faraday in this case. And he was intrigued by this and very open-minded about it. And he wanted to test two possibilities here. Either there's some external force, possibly a spirit is moving the table, or people are moving the table without realising it. And he did a series of really ingenious experiments, and I'll just describe one of them. Rather than getting people to put their hands directly on the table, he put layers of waxed paper on the table, and they put their hands on top of that. Now, once the session started, let's say the table moved to the right. If this was being moved by an external force, then people's hands would tend to drag behind it. So the paper, the wax paper, would be spread out to the left.
Right.
If people were pushing the table, even without, albeit not realising it, not consciously aware of it, then the table would be tending to drag behind the hands, and so you get the opposite pattern, and needless to say, you can imagine what Faraday found.
Yes.
But again, it's a nice example of somebody taking a proper, open-minded, experimental approach and drawing a very clear conclusion. It's what we call the ideomotor effect, when there's a suggestion or an expectation of movement of a particular kind, and actually it is the person who is supplying the muscular energy, but without any conscious awareness that they're doing it.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, plugging time.
Woo!
What are you going
right. I mean, for any listeners who are kind of into all this stuff, I think it's probably worth checking out our website, which is www.goldsmiths.ac.uk/APRU, which is obviously for Anomalistic Psychology Research Unit. And there's lots of stuff there. You can download some of our publications, for example. There's also details of our invited speaker program, which on some Tuesdays, we have invited speakers on Tuesday evenings. We had one last night. We had a very interesting talk from Simon Dean about a particular religious group and how they reacted when their leader died, and those who thought that he really was dead, and those that thought he wasn't, and so on. Next week we've got Daniela Rudloff from the Department of Psychology at the University of Leicester on mental shortcuts, the good, the bad and the ugly. And we've got a whole range of other interesting speakers lined up for the rest of this term and for next term. But if you go there, you can find the speaker list. I'd also recommend that if you are interested in coming for talks, which are free, there's no need to book, and they're open to the public. If you do want to come along, I would recommend that you subscribe to the Psychology of the Paranormal email list. Again, it's free, and it's just a way of allowing me to tell people about these events and other events that they might be interested in. It's not a discussion list, so we won't clog up your inbox. Another possible alternative is for notices which I have to get out very quickly, then Twitter is obviously good. I mean, my Twitter name is Chris C. French, all one word. So people might want to kind of have a look at that. What else have we got on our website? We just basically talk more about anomalistic psychology generally. There's, you know, details of some of the experiments that people can take part in. If they want to take part in our studies, then we're always interested in that. Another website I want to plug is the Skeptic website for the Skeptic magazine, which I edit. And that is www.skeptic.org.uk. And there are various links there. There's lots of stuff to explore. But obviously, the magazine, I'm going to give that a plug. We've been going now for over 20 years. We have a special offer on for new subscribers at the moment, so that if people go to the website, they can find details of that. It's basically, rather than paying £20 for a year's subscription, which is four issues, you can get a subscription for £15. Bigger discounts for longer term commitments, etc.
Okay.
And we've also, as I say, because we've been going for over 20 years, we've recently produced a Best of the Skeptic volume. This is edited by myself and Wendy Grossman, who was the magazine's founder. The book's called Why Statues Weep. And it's basically, as I say, a collection of the best of the articles from the last 20-odd years of a skeptic.
Okay.
And again, that's available. There's a link from the website, and you can get a discount on that when you go to the publisher's website. If you type in the code SKEPTIC, SKEPTIC with a K, you'll get 10% off the price, which is £13. That knocks it down to £11.70. I think that's it in terms of the adverts. I think, that's subliminal kind of advertising there, almost. It was so subtle, wasn't it?
Yeah, not good
enough. Exactly.
Slipped it. Okay, being as it's the first week and people are going to want to get used to this room, I'm going to end about 5 minutes early. Sorry, people. But I'm going to end by asking you a few questions and where you rate things on the Dorking Scale. For those who don't know, the Dorking Scale is a scale from 1 to 7. 1 means absolutely, completely true, totally true, 100%. And 7 means absolute, complete nonsense, total nonsense, 100%. So, Professor Chris French, are you ready?
I'm ready.
Ghosts.
6.
Alien visitation.
Yeah, 6.
Creationism.
7. All right, 6.9.
Dowsing.
Now, what do you mean by dowsing? This is one of those interesting questions. Going to be people douse. Does it really work?
Does it really work? In this case, does it work?
Yeah, no, 6.
The existence now of the Illuminati.
6. I'm glad you said now.
Yes. Well, we've got one more. The reptilian ruling class.
Oh, sod it. 7.
Astrology.
I think I'm going to have to go for... No, okay, 6.9.
6.9, yeah.
Yeah.
Homeopathy. Controversial.
6.9.
The scientific method.
Woohoo! A 1.
And finally, the big what? God.
Oh, 6.9.
Okay.
You've got to leave that room for doubt. I think that is important.
You do.
But on some of them, then it does get a little bit tricky. The thing about a notion like God is it even testable? You know,
yes.
I mean, you can test the power of prayer, you can test other aspects, but the basic notion is unfalsifiable at the end of the day. I personally am convinced by the kind of logical arguments against the existence of God, you know.
Yes.
How can we have free will if God is all-knowing and, you know, blah, blah, blah. The problem of evil, all that familiar stuff, is enough to convince me that God doesn't exist. But I might be wrong, who knows. If I am, well, he'll no doubt get his revenge on me, because apparently he's that kind of a guy, isn't he?
Yes, apparently so, in some cultures. Okay, well, that's it for this week. If you want to suggest guests, ask any questions, or just make general comments, it's skepticalexperience@gmail.com. And for this week, Professor Chris French, thank you very much.
Thank you.
See you next week. I don't want the rain.